Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
From the Missouri School of Journalism, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm Jim Flink. This week we're looking at the increasingly complex state of energy politics in Eastern Europe. Conflicts between Russia, which supplies much of the region's natural gas, and its neighbors are escalating. The United States government has increased sanctions on the Russian energy sector in response to the country's actions in Crimea and the Ukraine. How have markets been reacting to this? What does it mean for the area's balance of power? Joining us on Global Journalist today to talk about this topic, Tim Boersma, a fellow in the Energy Security Initiative at the Brookings Institution. Brian Wingfield is a reporter for Bloomberg News who covers energy and trade. And Corey Johnson is an associate professor of geography at the University of North Carolina, Greensboro. And thank you, one and all, for joining us today on Global Journalist. Appreciate it.
Great to be here.
So, Tim Boersma, yeah. Let's talk with you and let's talk about the recent events in Russia and in Crimea and Ukraine and what it all means from an energy perspective.
So far, thank you. Thank you, Jim. So far, from an energy perspective, it has not meant that much. It's been a security issue, and to date, you know, both oil and natural gas are flowing, but increasingly the threat of a supply disruption looms. And the question is whether or not we'll allow energy resources to be part of that equation. Now, there's been a lot of concern, but to date, both oil, as I said, both oil and gas are still flowing.
And yet, Corey Johnson, you know, Europe imports some 30% of natural gas from Russia. 50% of that gas exported to Europe flows through Ukraine. With tensions such as they are, 40,000 Russian troops mounted at the border, while it may not be a geopolitical issue yet, certainly that seems to loom, does it not?
Well, it is a geopolitical issue. It depends, I guess, on how you define geopolitics. But let me just frame the numbers a little bit differently than you just did and say that of Russia's exports, 24% go to Germany, and 57% of Russia's exports go to Western Europe, so Western European countries, not Poland and Slovakia and so forth. So I think when you look at it from that perspective, it becomes clear that Russia has a lot to lose by irritating and alienating Western European countries. So I think that's an important contextual piece of information to have.
Brian Wingfield, when you the Economist printed a very interesting map of the pipelines that flow from Russia throughout throughout all of Europe, and it is an impressive map to say the least. Europe stands in a very precarious position in that it doesn't want to push too hard against Russia in terms of this geopolitical stance, does it?
Right. The economic ties between the European Union and Russia are pretty close. If you look at the U.S., the situation is a bit different. In fact, only about 1% of all U.S. trade deals with Russia. We have a trade deficit with Russia right now. We're getting primarily petroleum products from them. So you're not going to see – you'll probably see louder voices in the United States calling for sanctions than you do in Europe for that exact reason.
So let's talk a little bit, Tim Boersma, about the nuts and bolts of this, the flow of energy, and you know, you note that you don't think this should be a geopolitical issue. Why not? And how does it not become that?
Well, no, I think it is already a geopolitical issue. I don't think it should be an energy issue, and the reasons have been touched upon before by the other two is that the costs, in particular, the cost for Europe would be very substantial, if not extremely high, and quite frankly, if you look at the sanctions that have been issued so far, I think they show very well that both Europe and also the United States are not really willing to bite the bullet, and if that is the case, and we can observe this, then you know I would argue that it may be better to tone down on the rhetorics and look for alternative solutions, because it seems to me that both the EU, certainly the EU and probably also the US, are not really ready to go ahead with this.
And do you see that as likely? I mean, is that the reason that you see, Tim, that maybe for now, even though there's certainly a lot of saber rattling going on, that cooler heads are at least at the time being prevailing?
Well, I think what I see so far is a European Union that is not willing, and I think mostly for economic reasons, as was mentioned earlier, to really get tough on Russia. I think the Americans, quite frankly, are just not willing to get into this too far. Americans are fed up with conflicts around the world and have issues and want to focus on other issues, particularly domestic issues. And so if that's the sum of it all, and it sounds very harsh, if the sum of it all is that Ukraine is just not, you know, in the broader perspective, not worth the hassle and we're not going to go for it, then, you know, we should be honest about that and look for alternative solutions. And then making all this noise now and then realizing later when Putin may invade eastern Ukraine, Moldova, Transnistria, then realizing, oh, we're not going to do anything after all, I think that's not a wise strategy at all.
Brian, in terms of the issue, Russia claims that the Ukraine owes one of Russia's gas giants something in the neighborhood of $1.7 billion. And while some consider that a bit of a dubious figure because apparently the gauges don't really read true, what kind of problems does that create in this ongoing situation?
Well, we've heard this. We've seen this movie before, right? I mean, in 2006 and 2009, there were similar issues, and Russia curbed the gas supplies to Ukraine. So we've been down this road before, and I think particularly after the last round in 2009, you saw Europe trying to diversify its energy supply a little bit more. What's been happening in the United States in recent years, particularly, I guess, within the past year or so, you've heard a lot of people in Congress in Washington talking about expediting approvals for natural gas exports. And that is something that has really gotten momentum in D.C. because of this Ukraine situation. Now, the problem with that is most of these facilities aren't even built yet. And
right.
Even if they were, they couldn't start shipping gas for a while, probably 3 or 4 years. So any help that the United States could provide to Ukraine at this point from that standpoint is going to be very limited.
Well, and couple that with the fact that very few companies, I would think, Corey Johnson, are going to take the risk of investing any sort of capital to even develop that kind of thing. Very few Western countries, I would think, with the political situation being such as it is, yes?
Right. There's a lot of sort of, we would call it path dependency here. I mean, you're absolutely right that companies don't want to invest the capital if there's a lot of risk. But also, there's the fact that Russia and Europeans are already investing huge amounts of capital in building pipes to pipe Russian gas to Western Europe. The Nord Stream pipeline, for example, that goes under the Baltic Sea, and the South Stream pipeline, which is currently on hold, but Russia is willing, Gazprom and its European partners are willing to spend $40 billion to build this under the Black Sea. So, and couple that with the fact, if I could just add, that shale gas from the U.S. that is shipped by liquefied sort of form by a tanker across the Atlantic is going to be much more expensive than pipeline gas through either the South Stream or existing pipelines. So you've got that additional dynamic as well.
Well, and it seems that some of the pundits and policymakers in Washington are talking about sort of providing pressure on Russia. Russia has not only a wealth and the means to deliver to Europe, but to elsewhere, I mean, to China and other places. And so this idea that somehow you could marginalize Russia in this process seems a little bit far-fetched, does it not?
It does.
Right. Brian. I think that's right. But one of the issues, though, is you have to have the customers in place. And I don't know if Russia does have those alternate customers in place at the moment.
And go ahead, Corey.
Well, I was just going to say you're absolutely right that it's a lot of talk, and particularly out of Washington, there's been all sorts of, you call it saber rattling, I would say sort of naive blustering about making Russia not part of the equation of supplying gas exports to European partners or to Asians and whatnot. And I think that's completely unrealistic.
You're listening to Global Journalist. I'm Jim Flink. Today we're talking about gas politics in Russia, how it impacts relations with the rest of Europe. Joined by Tim Boersma, who is a fellow of the Energy Security Initiative at the Brookings Institution. Brian Wingfield is a reporter for Bloomberg News who covers energy and trade. And Corey Johnson is an associate professor of geography at the University of North Carolina, Greensboro. Would also like to remind you that you can listen to this and other full episodes of Global Journalist on our website, that is globaljournalist.org. For more Global Journalist content, you can also like us on Facebook, or you can follow us on Twitter, that is at Global Jorn. And picking up the conversation from there, and I'll just open it up to any of the three of you, there's this talk now of alternative energy. And the interesting thing is that, you know, we get this far into a crisis and we talk about things that are alternatives, but those take time to build. So,
yeah, sorry, I'll jump in. Yeah, that's very true. I think that the alternatives are take time, and I think all of them do. We've touched upon on the LNG exports, which will take a long time. We've touched upon, the alternative supplies from Europe, and there are some available, but one of the problems continues to be that although Europe has invested substantially in pipeline capacity to better interconnect their markets, there's still quite a lot of work to be done there. And that has all to do with the fact that most of these markets are pretty small, and so that prohibits the market from investing. And it comes down to the question: do either European policymakers or related institutions want to invest in that infrastructure? And quite frankly, they don't have the mandate to do it, and I may not be willing to. And so that turns into this vicious circle. And we mentioned earlier, we talked about the future LNG terminals that may be built in Eastern Europe. I would very much question whether they will be built at all, for the reason I just mentioned, that the markets are very small. And with a small market, you know, the interest of private capital investors is just not going to be sufficient.
And policymakers here at home, Corey Johnson, might think this is the ideal opportunity to push some of the shale refinement that you've talked about. And yet that of itself is also a long-term project. There's nothing ready to ship at this point, and probably a best-case scenario would be, what, about a year out from now, 2 years?
Oh, several years. I mean, I would say that the unconventionals revolution here in North America is going to continue no matter what happens in Europe or in the Ukraine. But if I could just sort of take a step back, you asked about renewables. One of the short-term consequences here, because sort of adding renewable capacity takes a long time and is very expensive, the short-term alternative in places like Europe is actually coal. And we've actually seen that over the last year or two, that Europeans are burning more coal, and a lot of that coal is actually being imported from the United States. So one of the unintended consequences of the shale gas revolution here in the U.S. and in Canada to some extent as well, has been that all of that coal out of Wyoming and West Virginia and elsewhere has to find a market because it's actually cheaper to produce. And one of those markets it's finding are places like Germany, which is often touted as the home of the sort of the alternative energy revolution.
And Brian Wingfield, in your reporting, do you see that is a viable alternative for some folks who might be trying to wean themselves off of Russian natural gas?
That's actually being discussed. I know there's at least one U.S. company that has proposed a conversion from natural gas to clean coal technologies, which they say would be a little bit more efficient and actually have fewer greenhouse gas emissions. That would be in Ukraine. Another interesting phenomenon. I know that the Ukrainians themselves are trying to promote their own biomass industry and try to get that as a renewable industry going. Was mentioned earlier that is the obvious problem is if you have a fluid political situation in Ukraine, you don't know what the future is going to hold. It's tough to get investors in these projects. So there's that hurdle that needs to be overcome.
Surely, Tim Boersma, somewhere along the line, long before Ukraine popped to the center of the world stage, someone had to look at this infrastructure that Russia was building in Europe with all the pipelines and say, what happens if something goes awry here? And so should this be as much of a surprise to us as it is?
Well, yes and no. I mean, I think those questions have been asked, and ironically, they may have been asked more pressingly in the United States than they have in Europe. I mean, when this was constructed, and we're talking a number of decades ago, In Europe, this all grew pretty naturally, and quite frankly, the member states that were mentioned earlier, mostly in Western and Northern Europe, have enjoyed stable supplies for about 50 years now. And so their questions were never asked because, quite frankly, they were just pretty stable trade relations with Russia. The questions were asked, amongst others, in the Reagan administration in the 1980s, where there was indeed concern on the U.S. side about, you know, increasing dependence on Russia and whether that was such a good idea. But again, given the stable trade relations of the larger consuming countries in Europe, that in Europe was never really an issue. Now, that has changed dramatically with the expansion of the European Union, with 10 member states in 2004, if I'm not mistaken, when Poland, Hungary, and others joined. And those countries, of course, are much more dependent on Russia as a single source supplier in some countries even. And that brings new issues. And, of course, they have a different history in dealing with Russia. And so it has changed the debate in Europe and also made it very difficult to address the issue of Russia.
So necessity is the mother of invention, and certainly people will begin to work on some solutions, at least while this is hot. Nonetheless, Brian Wingfield, how does it play out in the shorter term in terms of how the EU and other, you know, European allies try to bring pressure to bear against Russia?
Well, it's going to be very, very tricky for any of this to happen because in recent years you've seen economic ties strengthen between Russia and the EU and Russia and the United States. I think one thing that has kind of gotten lost in this whole debate is something that happened a couple of years ago. Russia joined the WTO in 2012. And in order for the U.S. to be able to take action at the U.S. at the WTO with Russia, we had to change some of our Cold War trade limits. And when we did that, you saw a lot of U.S. businesses lobbying very hard to make this happen because they said, we want to invest more in Russia, we want to have stronger ties with them. And now you're seeing these sanctions come down. So it kind of flies in the face of everything that you heard out of the business community in Washington a couple of years ago. So right now we haven't seen any sanctions that have been really severe for the U.S. business community.
Corey Johnson, if it doesn't benefit Europe to play hardball necessarily here, that doesn't necessarily mean that Russia doesn't stand to lose something considerable should this continue to escalate and go to another level, right?
Yeah, and I suspect very much that people sitting in the Kremlin are thinking about those very questions, not the immediate term, because they're well aware that Europe has very few alternatives for its sources of energy. And winter is a long way off, but it is coming. And natural gas, of course, is what heats most homes in a lot of Europe. So I suspect what Vladimir Putin and others in the Kremlin are thinking about are the medium and long-term consequences of their action in Ukraine. These are not dumb people, and they're thinking strategically. They're not thinking completely irrationally, although we may have that impression looking at the news. But they will be considering the fact that, you know, if they decide to really sort of let everything go and invade eastern Ukraine and cause some brinkmanship with the West and with NATO, then they realize that a lot of the revenue that they get in the Kremlin, over 50% of their government tax revenues come from the export of petroleum and natural gas, that the medium and long-term consequences will be that Europe will indeed try even harder to find alternatives to that.
Again, to remind you, you're listening to Global Journalist. I'm Jim Flink. Today, we're looking at gas politics in Russia and how it impacts relations with the rest of Europe. Joined today by Tim Boersma, who is a fellow of the Energy Security Initiative at the Brookings Institution. Brian Wingfield is a reporter for Bloomberg News. He covers energy and trade. And Corey Johnson is an associate professor of geography at the University of North Carolina, Greensboro. You can listen to this and other full episodes of Global Journalist on our website. That's globaljournalist.org. For more, you can also like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Global Journ. So we talk about the fact that Russia certainly must be aware. I want to throw out something, and I don't know how far-fetched it is, but certainly the folks in Ukraine understand that they're sitting on top of pipelines that send 50% of Europe's natural gas that direction. I guess the question I would have is if this continues to escalate, and I'll open this to you, Brian Wingfield, first, and then if anybody else wants to jump in, what is the possibility that if things get really bad and tensions begin, and Russia invades, that maybe there's a terrorist strike or something like that on some of these facilities?
Well, I would not speculate on what might happen as far as a terrorist strike.
Right.
You know, I have to say I haven't covered the internal politics of that specifically. I've been focused more on the U.S. side, so
right.
I'd probably defer to the other two on the call on this.
Right, right. But, I mean, is that out of the question given the desperate nature of the events that are going on there?
I don't think anything really is out of the question. I mean, you've seen a lot of changes happen in Ukraine in the past 2 months, and it seems to be changing by the hour. So I think we have to be prepared for anything.
Sure. And go ahead. Jump in.
I was just going to jump in. This is Corey, and suggest that, I mean, in all of this, we've heard about Russia, you know, raising the price of gas to the Ukraine. But what we haven't heard about the fact is that Russia and Western Europe and Eastern Europe, to a large extent, rely on the goodwill of the Ukraine allowing that gas to pass through the pipeline. And of course, the Ukraine is the longest stretch of that of those export pipelines. And what I have wondered is to what extent the Ukrainian government would be prepared to say to Russia, look, if you want to play this game, we'll not allow that gas to pass to Europe, and what will happen then. So I think that's perhaps more likely a scenario than a terrorist attack. But I would agree with Brian that, you know, anything is possible.
So let's talk about the impact that all of this is having on markets. Have prices gone up? They have not, have they?
No, they have not. They've not. And I would agree with what I just heard both Brian and Corey say, and also remind of you know what happened, the pricing disputes that were mentioned earlier. I think a big part of the solution lies in Ukraine itself. An energy sector that is highly corrupt, and we've known this for 20, 25 years, and it hasn't changed. Well, the Prime Minister has openly said just recently that about 40% of the money that flows into the sector disappears in the pockets of just a few. And so I think there's a lot of work that needs to be done in Ukraine, and hopefully the IMF budget that became available today can help doing that. Although I would caution that, again, this is a problem we've known for 20, 25 years. So there's a lot of work to be done in Ukraine in particular. And so far, it continues to be a key transit state, and it has an important position in that respect. The Russians have been very explicit that they want to continue delivering natural gas and oil and coal to Europe because it is an important supplier. So I don't think both Russia and the EU have an interest in turning this into an energy matter. Ukraine could change that, and quite frankly, in the current constellation, events can change very rapidly. It's hard to say what will happen.
And depending country by country, some countries have a fairly large amount of storage, as I understand it, while others don't enjoy that same benefit. Again, to propose hypotheticals, and I understand that we're really not in the prediction business nonetheless, does that help ease some of this in terms of the European situation, Corey Johnson?
Absolutely. I mean, in the ideal sort of circumstance in Europe, you would say that if something were going to happen in which Europe needed to use its leverage with Russia, it would be right about now. It would be sort of in late spring because most of the gas consumption is in the winter, in the heating months. But as I understand it, the statistics suggest that countries like Germany and others more in the western sort of side of Europe have upwards of a month or two, even more, of reserve storage of natural gas, which they could use sort of as at least a short-term leverage or hedge against Russian activities, and also as a sort of an instrument of their foreign policy. But I think that's circumstantial. I mean, I think it would depend on what the circumstance is, but they certainly have that at their disposal.
And Brian Wingfield, does the fact that this is in the spring buy negotiators on all sides a little bit of time for this not to sort of escalate in a way that it might if it were the dead of winter?
I think a little bit. I mean, natural gas is used for heating and electricity, so you don't quite have the heat problem that you did 2 months ago, but you still have issues with providing power to people who need to have the lights on.
And so yeah. it maybe does buy them a little bit of time.
A little bit.
Go ahead.
Sorry, I would just briefly, I would add that, I mean, that yes, in the short run, that may be true, but I think that for the European Union, it's much more important to have a longer-term perspective. I mean, there's a You're talking about one of the most, if not the most important supplier of natural gas and oil to the European Union. And so it is, in my view, unless we're willing to pay substantial premium because we want to diversify our supplies entirely away from Russia, which I think is not a very viable strategy, if only because it's so costly, but if it were practically feasible. I don't think that's the way to go. And so if you have a longer-term perspective and you know that Russia is going to be an important supplier of energy resources, then that's not the way to go. And the way to go is get back to the negotiation table and solve this issue and make sure this is not about energy resources and supply disruptions, because it's in no one's interest.
And Tim, if you go back to the negotiation table specifically, what moves the needle, so to speak?
Well, that's a great question. I wish I knew. I do know that I have at least the impression that the current path we're walking down is not working. I mean, we continuously hear that Russia is becoming increasingly isolated, and I see that very differently. If you look at the UN vote on calling the actions in Crimea criminal, then you see a long list of large, important countries that abstain from voting. I mean, we're talking China, India, Brazil, South Africa, Argentina, and so on and so forth. So Russia is not being isolated. That's not the case. We have a transatlantic partnership versus a Russian aggressor, and that's what we're talking about. Now, the Chinese authorities recently, just a few days ago, issued an interesting statement in which they said, you know, we don't think this is the right way to go. The sanctions are only further escalating things, and this should be de-escalated. I think that I would be very interested to learn what the Chinese mean by that. Of course, skeptics would say the Chinese are never interested in doing anything, but it would be worth listening to them, because I think that may provide other opportunities to solve this instead of further escalating it with sanctions that, quite frankly, do not have the teeth that they should have to be really effective.
Brian Wingfield, thoughts on what comes next in all of this?
Well, that's the big question. I mean, Putin has said that he doesn't really have any interest in imposing sanctions right now. The U.S. seems to be having very targeted sanctions that haven't affected really any of the major Russian energy companies, although I guess the biggest fish so far is a sanction against the president of Rosneft, the oil company. But it seems like there's no real defined end game on this.
And some of these sanctions that are being imposed, Corey Johnson, seem to be largely symbolic. It doesn't seem like they're really causing any great damage at this point to any effect on Russia.
I think they are largely symbolic by design. It's because the underlying realities are something that we cannot avoid, that we can't ignore. The fact that Russia has the largest reserves of natural gas in the world, one-fourth the world's proved reserves, it has a lot of the world's oil. And frankly, I don't think Europeans or Americans or others are prepared to deal with the consequences of drawing red lines with Russia over Ukraine when it might mean the price of oil spikes by 100% or that gas supplies are interrupted. Frankly, I haven't seen a lot of appetite for that, and probably for good reason.
I want to thank all three of you for joining us on this edition of Global Journalist. It's a production of the Reynolds Journalism Institute and the Missouri School of Journalism. Our thanks to our guests today, Tim Boersma of the Brookings Institution, Brian Wingfield with Bloomberg News. Thank you very much. And Corey Johnson as well with the University of North Carolina, Greensboro.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you all. Our executive producer is Casey Morell. Our lead producer this week is Olga Krispileva, with assistance from Tyler Kastner, Jake Godin, and Christina Sanchez. Travis McMillan from the Reynolds Journalism Institute is our technical director. Please do join us again next week for another edition of Global Journalist. I'm Jim Flink. Thanks a lot for listening.